You ever wonder about the people in family photos or ever try to ask who these people really were? Every face is a narrow escape or a love story that almost didn't happen. Your family stories are hidden in plain view. You just haven't accessed it yet. There are versions of these rebels and dreamers before life told them who they needed to be. And I'm not talking about the shiny stories everyone knows. I'm talking about the soul-crushing experiences with heartbreaks and real loss. You gotta preserve these stories now. So contact thevietnamstorybank.com today. No polish, just raw, recorded, beautiful history that makes you sit up and hold your breath. We dig it all up, record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, unerased, untouchable, and unforgettable. Don't let silence have the last word. Go to vietnamstorybank.com today. Make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome to the Vietnamese Podcast. Today I have Kevin Quat. You are a Blue Origin aerospace engineer, and you and I met in New York last week. And we were in a club in the back room in an enclave, and we were just talking about the stuff that you do, and I found it so interesting. I always found the Blue Origin and SpaceX rocket companies as a very these very interesting companies. And the more we talked, I mean, I knew that I'd have to ask you on to the podcast, but the more we talked, the more I wanted to really explore this idea of space travel and the ideas behind the technology. So welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thanks, Kent. It's always good to see you again. New York was a good time.
It's a great time. So let's talk about how early in your life did you have this idea of wanting to become a rocket scientist?
Yeah. So, I would say pretty early on, growing up as a kid, my dad, he had all sorts of stuff in the living room. Like, he had all these books, like encyclopedias with like just pictures of airplanes, like literally it's a picture book, except it's just full of jets and all sorts of aircraft. He had models all over the fireplace of little planes on the shelves and here, things like that. And I would, I'd read through the books because, pictures, right? Picture books, you kids love them, right? So instead of picture books of Barney or Winnie the Pooh, I was looking at picture books of like military aircraft and jets and airplanes. And I had that influence pretty young, right? As soon as I could really read on my own. a aerospace engineer or work with rockets specifically. I just had I knew I wanted to build something, right? Make something. I thought I might be an architect, right? When I was in elementary school, I was like, oh, maybe I want to be an architect. I would draw buildings and like, oh, maybe I can design buildings when I get older. And then in middle school, I wasn't quite sure in middle school either yet exactly if it was going to be aerospace or rockets or anything like that. And it really took hold, I think, when I was in high school and I really started thinking, your brain's a little bit more formed, in high school. And you're like, oh, what do I actually want to do? And from there, I pretty much knew I wanted to do aerospace or some form of engineering. And I just looked back at all my memories and all the things that like I really connected with as a kid. And I was like, I got to do something with planes or it's got to be something that flies. Right. And so coming out of high school, I was pretty dead set. I knew where I wanted to go to school. I knew what I wanted to study. And it just took off from there, really.
Is aerospace engineering one of those fields where it's like a very narrow window, like the medical field, if you want to be a doctor, is it hard to get in?
Yeah. So I would say relatively speaking, aerospace engineering is probably a smaller group of folks who are getting degrees in that compared to maybe more general engineering degrees, like mechanical type of degrees. Yeah. It's a bit more niche in a sense. I like to think of aerospace engineers like a jack of all trades, but master of none type of field, because you have to learn about all the different systems that compose of modern day aircraft or launch vehicles or rockets, right? And so to fully understand the whole system, you have to learn about it at all, right? Like rockets and planes are not simple aircraft or you know, inventions, right? They comprise of many, many, many small systems. So we have to learn about all of them. So I would say we have a pretty good understanding of what it all takes to put the plane together or the rocket together. But we still, as an aerospace engineer, he only goes so deep, right? It's like the breadth and versus the shallow. So not to detract that I don't know my disciplines, right? But I would say, you know, as an aerospace engineer, you're more focused on how to put all those things together, focusing on a system that is capable of flying. I would say that's more of what aerospace is focused on.
Yeah, it makes sense. So, all right, we're going to get into the wacky side of this conversation first, because I think by talking about the wacky side of this conversation, we're gonna expose how much you know, which is a lot. And when we were sitting in New York, I wasn't trying to test you. I was like, legit, this has always been on my mind, and I know it's on a lot of my friends' mind. And I get sent these like really wacky, you know, Instagram posts, but I just have to go for it because I think it's gonna make a lot of sense once the audience. Here's what I'm about to ask. Okay. Yeah. This thing about the moon landing being a hoax. Can you walk me through this again? I know you did it in New York with me, but walk it through me again, because I think hearing you explain it to me makes so much sense. And I'm going to send this, obviously this interview, this conversation to many of my friends who believe that the lunar moon landing was not real. And it frustrates me. It frustrates my brother when we hear it. But I think the way you explained it to me really makes a lot of sense. So here we go.
Yeah. So I can kind of see why people would question that, right? Because you think, wow, okay, you know, 1969 technology back then, right? Like we were running cars with carburetors. The digital electronics wasn't big, right? Like we didn't have phones, PCs. Like there was we're at the advent of really computing at that time, right? So I can understand, and it's an incredible feat, right? To send people into space and onto the moon and come back, right? Like that's an incredible feat. And even today's standards, I would still say that that's pretty remarkable, right? Like today we still have trouble reliably putting vehicles on the moon. I mean, we do it, right? We haven't put a person on the moon recently, but things are landing on the moon, you know, every year. Different countries are putting things on the moon. I mean, the company I work for is trying to put, you know, people back on the moon again this year. So I'd say I can understand the hesitation or the skepticism, right, when it comes to, especially if you weren't around during that time, right? But I would say don't underestimate the technology of people decades ago, right? They were in a different time of technology doesn't mean they were much less capable, right? And you got to think, like, you know, and I won't get too far into the weeds of like other theories, I'll call them theories, right? Like, you know, think about like the pyramids, think about the aqueducts, think about any other great monument that humankind has created, or any other great feat that humankind has made. It, like, they've been making these things for centuries, for millennia, right, with different forms of technology. Just because they don't have today's technology doesn't mean they can't accomplish feats of greatness, right? So I would say, you know, if you really read into the people, the math and the science that was involved with going to the moon, these things are all grounded in reality, right? Like the physics behind it, it's makes
doable.
Sense.
These things, right, are doable.
Yeah,
back
of
then.
Course. Yeah, like the things are, there's physically, the physics hasn't changed, right? Like what it takes to get off the Earth, escape, you know, Earth's sphere of influence, get into orbit, transfer to the moon's orbit, and land and come back. Like, the physics don't change, right? The physics have been there forever, right? Like, it just took us a while to understand the math and derive all this stuff and then apply the technology to get us there. And so I think it's perfectly expected to have that skepticism, but at the same time, it's like, you know, we as humans, we as mankind are very capable when we organize teams together and have the right people in the room, and you really focus on what it takes to accomplish that mission, right? Because if you are, you know, I read books about the whole Apollo 11 and the landing, and I mean, these were serious teams. You know, I really respect the people that were part of that mission, and I believe every minute of it, right? Of course, there's going to be some forward-facing, public-facing aspect that they always want you to see. You're never going to show your dirty laundry, right? Like, of course, documentaries come out after the fact, and they tell you all these crazy things about the people behind the scenes, about what really happened as far as, like, the politics and the angst and the difficulties and the challenges they had, right? They want to say, hey, yeah, we had a good time. We accomplished the mission. You don't want to show too much of that where you know, the dirty laundry of the engineering, right? But like these were very committed teams, and I just read about all the rehearsal, all the practice, all the different options that they had, and I think a lot of that had to do with the success, even when it looked like it was almost an impossible task, right? Like these guys were planning like a laundry list of different options of how you could do this. There wasn't just an option A, you know, there was an option A, B, C. You ran out of letters in the alphabet, right? You had to go back around and come up with more options. But because that's the idea, right? Like, because of the technology limitations and other constraints at the time, you had to, you know, like I say, with, you know, if you've ever seen his book's title, Gene Kranz's title of the book, right? It's called Failure is Not an Option. And that's literally it. Right. Like they had to accomplish this task, and you couldn't accept no, right? You couldn't accept failure. You had to come up, if this happened, how do you get around it? Right. And they had a how do you get around it answer for almost everything, every possible situation they could think of. Right. And these things did happen, right? They had lots of failures. They had lots of issues. And not everybody knows about it. They think, oh, was it perfect? No, of course not. There's always little things that happen. And any one of those things could have stopped the mission, right? Now, today, with today's technology, we can mitigate that way more effectively, right? Like the number of things that could cause the mission to stop, you know, the likelihood of that has certainly dropped, I would say, and with today's technology. So even though they were limited at the time and they had a higher chance of failure, they were still able to do it. So, you know, I very much believe that it happened, of course. You know, asking an aerospace engineer if the lunar landing has happened is like asking of a, you know, a baker believes in bread, right? It's like, it's just totally, it's fundamental to the study and the existence. To accomplish these really highly technical tasks that rely on a series of events that have to occur all right, you know, many times during that process, you have outs, I'll call them. Like you have ways of getting around a situation. Like there are checkpoints, right? And at every checkpoint, you have like a pick your own adventure type of deal. Like based on what's happening, you do this, right? If this is nominal, okay, you pick option A. If something is slightly off, okay, you do option B. If this is slightly off and that is slightly off, and you know it's a Wednesday, you do option C. You know, it's a very long list of all these different things that will enable you to continue the mission and complete, you know, the objectives. Whereas today, now we still have like many critical decision points when it comes to, you know, flying a mission to space, right? But with today's technology, we can leverage a lot of automation, a lot of computing, a lot of rapid decision-making capability is now embedded into computers and algorithms, whereas in the 70s, yeah, they had some of that, I would say, but they had a lot more people in the loop, humans in the loop, right, making these decisions. And that's subject to human error, subject to human discretion, ego, personalities, you know. Whereas today's technology, a lot of it is more calculated with computers, that computers are making these decisions, right? So I think that's the big difference between then and now, right? Like we can do what they did, and they can do what we did, albeit we, with today's technology, we're just way more efficient with it, right? Like their computers were much heavier, right? They had to have people, you know, to do this, because not everything could be controlled from ground, right? From the control room, from wherever. So whereas today, you know, a lot of the automation can occur. You don't actually have to have people to do a lot of this stuff. Now, I mean, it can help in certain situations because of comms losses and things like that. But I think that's the big paradigm shift is we're not today. It's like, it's the difficulty is not necessarily in, now it's still difficult, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's the primary thing that's holding us up. It's not that we can't go back. It's, how can we go back for way less money and bring a lot more stuff with us, right? And do it way more safe than they did it in the Apollo missions, you know?
So two things. I think before we actually got to the moon, we actually lost a crew, right? Right before?
Yeah, so there was the Apollo 1 fire. Okay. Yeah, so that was an incident that happened on the launch pad. They lost the crew and the capsule during that operation.
You know, and the other part is the actual pictures that people claim, you know, the flag and the direction of the sun and all of this, like, sort of hoax style photography, you know. And I ask this knowing full well, you know, I don't believe in it as being a hoax. I really believe that we got to the moon. But the way you explain why these pictures were taken has something to do with the modern narrative of Blue Origin and Katy Perry and her team coming out of that capsule, people saying that's like the door, you know, looked fake and, you know, how flimsy it looked. So it all ties in, and you have, I hate to say you have an explanation for this, but I mean, what you described to me makes so much sense. So can you tell me?
Yeah. So, right. I mean, whenever you do something, especially for the first time, right? Like, you don't always want to show everybody the dirty underneath, right? Like, it's always, you do have to worry about PR. There's public reception, right? How do people see this? You don't want to show yourself as, oh man, we barely did this. Oh, like, these people almost died. Like, oh, this was the most terrible, uncomfortable thing, you know, because people don't like to see that, right? They like to see pretty pictures. They like to see, you know, everything through, you know, rose colored lenses, as they say, right? You want to make it look good, right? Especially if it's going to be on TV. So you know, I'm not part of the, I wasn't part of the mission that flew, you know, on that New Shepard with Katy Perry and the rest of the crew. However, you know, to the extent that I would say as a person who, you know, and obviously my words are not Blue Origin's words, right? But, you know, think about it, right? Like, if you're flying a whole bunch of high profile people into space and back, right? There's going to be cameras, right? There's going to be people filming. It's going to be on all sorts of social media, and it's advertising for the company, right? So yes, the mission went, they left, they came back. I know that with fact, right? But I'm sure at some point they were like, hey guys, we got to do this one for the photo, right? Mm-hmm. So how much of that was for, you know, how much of that you actually know of, like, how the day progressed and how they did the filming for it? It's hard to say because I wasn't there, right? But, you know, let's just remember, like, you know, even, like, think about it, right? With the wedding photo, right? 90% of your wedding photos were taken like 10 times over, right? Like, because you want to show the best part of the event. Was the wedding real? Of course it was real, right? You have the documents, you have the ring to prove it, right? But you need to make it look good too. So I think there's a balance of that aspect. And then whenever people find out, like, oh my God, that's not the real photo, like, yeah, well, the real photo is like muddy and it's dark and you can't really see anything, you know, like, you want to have that outside. Now, that's just me as a, if I were running my own company, that's what I would do, right? I can't speak to what was actually done. But I was like, you know, hey, you know, hold on, people, like, let's just think about this for a second and not jump to conclusions with these kinds of things.
Yeah. I think it's just human nature too. When we, you know, some of these friends of mine that I have are really into conspiracy, and it's not, you know, it's not the most, intelligent, you know, I have to say, it's not the most intelligent debates that we have. It's like, you know, it gets exhausting to hear this over and over, flat earth debates and you know, moon landing conspiracy. It just makes no sense to me. And that's why I want to sit and talk to you about the idea of space travel and, you know, what the realities are and what you do all ties into, you know, now expanding our mind, and we're now moving into the future. And I think it's to my good friends who believe in this, all these conspiracies about, you know, Blue Origin not making it into space and you know, the US not making it onto the moon back then. you know, we need to put all that to rest, and we need to really hear what these real life engineers do. A real life Vietnamese engineer is doing at Blue Origin. So, you know, so here we are. What is your day to day like?
Yeah, so, you know, I work over at the Cape, Cape Canaveral, right? It's where all the history was made back in the day in the 60s and 70s. You know, that's where NASA is. It's where Kennedy Space Center is. The Space Force Base is over there now. So every day, you know, I commute over there, over to the coast. You know, I work right next to a lot of industry. So it's really cool. Actually, driving into work, I can see the visitor center at Kennedy Space Center. And they have, you know, the old shuttle tank. And it's sitting outside, and I can see that every day. It's really cool. You can see the VAB way off in the distance, which is like, you know, one of the world's largest, you know, structures that can hold a rocket inside. So I work over there, but on a day-to-day basis, you know, it could be, you know, I'm actually down there on the manufacturing floor, working on the rocket. Doing, you know, I work a lot on the avionics and electrical parts of the rocket. So it could be, I'm doing a test on there. I'm troubleshooting, or maybe somebody ran into a problem. The part of the system's not working. So my job is to go down there, figure out why it's not working, give them dispositions, write up engineering instructions on how to fix it, how to correct the problem, or how to just conduct the general tests to make sure that the rocket's working, right? So that's fundamentally my role, if you want to put it simply, is I'm responsible for, you know, when they build the rocket, I'm responsible for making sure that specific parts of that rocket, because there's many systems, right? But I have a couple systems I particularly own. I'm responsible that those systems, you know, work. Like, you know, I can put a stamp on it. I say, okay, my name is on this piece of paper that says, you know, Kevin says that this part of the rocket works, right? Like, stamped. Okay, good to go, right? So it can be a variety of things. It could be, yeah, fixing, finding problems, troubleshooting, or just doing routine tests and inspections on as we build the rocket.
And do you ever, this is probably a silly question, but do you ever see things that are defected? Do you ever come across things that are not going to work and somebody before you passed it along and it was just...
Of course. I mean, that's the point of the job, right? The point, if people didn't make mistakes, you know, my job would be pointless. Like, my function only exists because we have to assume that mistakes were made.
Yeah.
Right. And so we're the integration team. We make sure that it was integrated properly. So of course, yeah, we find things. I'm like, all right, who's the guy who did this? You know, like, but yeah, you know, that happens every now and then, but that's expected, right? Any complicated manufacturing process, you're always going to have something go wrong, whether it was, you know, a design issue or just a defect during, you know, manufacturing. Like, I, you know, one day somebody just picked up the wrong thing and used it where it wasn't supposed to be used, and we catch that, right? Or somebody just makes a human simple error, like, oh, he misread something, and then my job is to go in and test and make sure that any simple mistake like that gets caught, right? We can't allow simple human error to transpire all the way through a manufacturing process, and ultimately my job is to catch all of those. So if I catch something, that means my job was I'm doing my job successfully, right?
Because I'm thinking, when you're doing something this complicated, a million things can go wrong, right? And a million things just takes one thing, like an O-ring for the Challenger to blow up in space. And that's what I'm thinking to myself, how many guys like you exist on your team to troubleshoot, to do quality control before these things get rolled up into space and, you know, you're carrying human beings into your the whole idea of Blue Origin is to bring public regular people up into space, right? So I mean, there's going to be hundreds of these missions in the next decade. I'm assuming, and this is how many of you guys are testing, and how many, you know, I'm trying to wrap my mind around like the process of like getting it all figured out that it's safe enough for us to go into space.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my team's like about 17 people. And that's just one team. We have partner teams that also, you know, do similar roles as us. And that's, so that's like 17 engineers. Plus we have another team that's almost about 30. they're going to end up around with 30 some odd engineers. And so between all, I don't know, so that's like 40 or 50 some odd people on the floor working with the rocket, getting through production, getting through manufacturing and testing for all these things, right? And we're not the final say, right? We're just the people who during the manufacturing process are testing it, right? Once it's done, you know, they go out onto the launch pad and they do their, you know, final practice tests and everything too. And that's a whole another team. You know, that's the team where when you think of, you know, when you think of NASA, you know, you think of the control room, you know, with the big TVs in the front, and you have the people in the back wearing the shirts and the ties, you know, like the classic 90s, or not 90s, classic like 70s flying to the moon, you know, vibe, right? People smoking, I mean, they don't smoke cigars in the control room anymore, but there's a whole other launch ops team, right, that handles that too. And they're a pretty large team too. So it's a pretty big group of people that are responsible for this whole process. It takes many, many, you know, that's why, you know, space industry is not it's not cheap, right? When you get into this business, it takes a lot of money, right? And that's why you see people, only large companies are really big players in the space right now. But we're seeing, you know, smaller and smaller players come up here and there too, but really big barriers to entry because of the complexity, right? And because of how many people need to be involved with this process. Yeah.
How far are we from getting into space travel for the public on a regular sort of, I mean, is this happening already, or just we're only seeing like celebrities go up?
So I guess I would say, you know, by space travel, if space tourism, you know, call it, qualifies as space travel, then yeah. I would say, yeah, we're already there. Right. I mean, that's what New Shepard does. I mean, SpaceX has brought people into space too, right? They don't do it in the same light as what Blue Origin does. But I mean, space travel for ordinary people can happen today, right? Now it's just a matter of, you know, do you have the money to fund it and all that kind of stuff? It's not like jumping on the metro or something like that, right? But one day, right, that's the goal, right? One day the goal is to make it accessible, to make it simply like buying a ticket on a domestic, or I guess case more international, or I don't even know what you'd call it, right? What do you call a flight that leaves the Earth? It would be just buying a ticket like that and then going to wherever you need to go. So part of it is, yeah, we're there today in the sense that we bring small groups of people to space on a almost trivial basis, right? Like we've launched, you know, New Shepard launched, I think they were into their almost 30 flights. You know, SpaceX has brought many crews to the ISS and they do their own private missions as well. So we're there now to a certain degree. But I don't think we're too far, from the cost perspective, I think we have a ways to go. But from the capability perspective, I think, you know, we could do that today. We could bring anybody into space today. It's just how much money, yeah. Right?
Because cost seems to be around $200,000, $250,000 to get just one orbit into space. I mean, is that the sort of the going rate now?
Oh, man, I couldn't tell you. That's all the business side of the house, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to, yeah, for me, I'm more of the technical guy. If I were to try to sell you something like that, I'd get kicked out the door right now. I think he was two of the worst numbers ever.
Yeah. What is actually the mission of Blue Origin? Because I asked that because I know that SpaceX has its own mission, but Blue Origin seems to be more, a little bit more passenger, public passenger. Can you go into the actual mission of Blue Origin?
Yeah. So, I mean, so Blue Origin's motto, I guess I should say, it's, you know, for the benefit of Earth, right? That's our mission statement, I guess I would say. But what does that mean, right? Again, I'm not a spokesperson for Blue Origin, but I'll tell you what it means as me as an individual, right? What does that mean? And it's really, like we mentioned before, it's enabling people to travel off the earth on a regular, and I would say almost on a trivial kind of basis, right? We want to enable folks who for whatever they need to do, right? Whether that be private industry in space, right? Whether that be going to some commercial space station, whether that be going to the moon for whatever reason, for industry, for science, for tourism, right? To basically enable that, right? Because right now we look at traveling to space as an enormous feat, right? We look at it like how the Wright brothers looked at, you know, doing their first flights. We look at it how when the first domestic airline flights were happening, right? This is like, oh, this is so remarkable. This is novel. This is crazy. Like, you know, oh, do we really trust this, right? Like, think about when cars came versus, you know, horse-drawn carriages. It's like, oh, you can't trust these things. They run on explosions, right? In the machine. I think the mission long-term for Blue Origin is to kind of make that transition happen for humanity, right? We want to make it so that it's just the next form of transportation for all the humanity.
You know, when I think about your trajectory and your path, what kind of preparation do you need to do before you get to Blue Origin, right? Like, coming out of school, where did you have to like work before you actually got to a big company like Blue Origin? And like, what kind of things do young people have to think about if they want to go into a company like that?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's not easy, right? I mean, relatively speaking. I mean, there's obviously the schooling part of it, right? You got to go through an engineering school, and at that to get into the larger, more well-known, or I guess I would say reputable or prestigious employers, right? Like, you generally have to have some sort of rigorous education at some university that's recognized for that aerospace engineering. Now, I'm not saying that you have to do that. Obviously, if you have the ability and you have the talent, I would say personally, it doesn't matter where you went to school, but you have to show that somehow, right? So there's the academic rigor, right? That's part of it too. It wasn't easy getting through aerospace school. You know, the average GPAs were like on the floor, right? Like your grades were terrible.
Really?
It was very difficult. Yeah. But you make it through, right? You make it through that. So that's like step one, right? and then there's how you get to employment too, right? A lot of people, I mean, it's not a unique problem to aerospace engineering. It's probably unique to all college graduates, is how do you land that first job, right? Now, for me, you know, doing things like interning, you know, there's like co-op programs and things like that. Like that, those are all things that, you know, if I were talking to a student today, like, how do you prepare yourself for an industry job, especially in a sector like this? It's, well, you got to get experience, right? You got to get that internship, get that co-op before you even graduate, right? So you got to get experience before you even finish school.
Yeah.
That's part of it, right? And then, After I graduated, you know, I had those things, right? I had internships when I was in school. I was working through college. I had real world experience before I got out of school in aviation, right? I had worked with I worked with Gulfstream. They're based in Savannah. You know, they make private business jets, very nice ones. That's kind of where I picked up the industry experience of what does it mean to work on a modern day aircraft, right? With leading edge technology, with digital controls, how is it all put together? How do they work? How do you test it, right? How does the industry work? And that's kind of where I picked it up. And I was able to transfer that experience at Gulfstream into my first full-time job was actually with a company called Sikorsky. They're owned by Lockheed Martin now, but they make helicopters, right? They make helicopters like the Black Hawk. They're famous for making the Black Hawk helicopter. So I worked for Sikorsky, which is helicopters, for almost 8 years. Wow. I worked there. Yeah. I worked there as a flight test engineer. I flew on them, you know, in the back with the pilots. I had my own uniform. I had a helmet, and And, you know, my job there was to basically watch the, because these were experimental, right? My mom hated this. Like, what are you doing flying on experimental helicopters, right? Like, you're crazy. Like, stop doing that, right? But I would fly in the back, and my job was basically to make sure that the helicopter was okay. It was experimental, right? So, like, a lot of new tech was being vetted out, and we weren't it wasn't ready yet, right? So we were there to make sure. We just watched these screens and make sure, hey, you know, this is reading a little high, this is reading a little low. You know, I would tell the pilots, hey, you need to do this because, you know, X happened, so we do Y, right? We were like the human backup computer, basically, because we were still testing the actual computers, right? So it requires some of that. So I did that for quite a while, and I learned a lot about a lot about how modern aviation, modern aerospace, modern aircraft are put together. How do you test them? How do you monitor them? How do you show that they're operating normally, right? Like, you pick up that type of experience lets you pick up on a lot of cues, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, so, you know, when you bring like, and this is very, very key to what makes me or what makes a good engineer in my role, is you have to start learning these cues, right? Like, these snap decision cues, right? Because you can't always sit down. Like, you don't have the luxury to sit down, open your textbook and look at data for days, right? To make a decision. You have to be able to quickly over time. And this is where experience comes in, right? Like, look at those really important factors. Look at those really important cues, right? And based on your experience, what is this meant for you in the past, right? Okay. Well, typically, you know, when I see this happen, that's a pattern, right? And these patterns reoccur with these types of systems, right? They're not unique in and of themselves. Like, you know, there are novel issues, but many issues are like, oh, these are common type of issues. And you learn to pick up on those things, and that really improves your ability to make judgment and react and make the correct decision quickly, right? So you're not wasting a week with an aircraft that's not flying, right? You kind of like, oh, okay, I think I got this figured out. You're almost like a detective, right? Like, and the sharper you get and the quicker you can solve these problems, the more effective you become as a test engineer. So a lot of that experience I built up during the, you know, the 7 to 8 years there. And then I decided to, you know, look elsewhere. And then I carried all that experience over to Blue Origin, where I do, you know, test engineering now. So applying a lot of the same experience and principles of, you know, how do you properly test something, and, you know, how can you show something's working or not? That's kind of how the process occurred.
I don't know, but it just sounds to me that helicopters sound a lot more complicated in testing than a rocket. I could be wrong, but a rocket just seems like a tube that needs to go up at the right time and not blow up. But with helicopters, there's just so much going on, it seems like, with the balance, the propellers, and all of that. And did you ever come close to any, like, bad accidents?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I was in the back of one. We didn't actually hit anything, right? But we had a you know, a near miss, I guess you would say, right? But yes, you're right. Helicopters are complicated. And I think people underestimate the complexity of those machines, right? Just because they seem simple. They're not exciting, right? When you think of, like, flashy, high tech, cool, you don't think of a helicopter that's just flying around your house that's just making all this noise, right? Like, you know what I mean? But yeah, they are very complicated machines. The dynamics involved are very complex. There's a lot of moving parts, you know, the gearbox, transmission, the engine, the controls, the everything, right? like rockets, they appear to be simple too. So I would say you're right, and, you know, you're right in some of those aspects, right? People say, oh, it's rocket science, so therefore it must be ridiculously hard, right? But in some senses, it's actually not as complex as you would think.
Yeah.
Now there are, now that's a very broad and general statement, right? But if you stripped away if you were to just be shown the machine, right, and not understand what it's doing, like if I could show you a design for a rocket and not tell you it's a rocket, or tell you that it was something to go to space with, and I could show you a design for a helicopter, right? And then not tell you that, oh, this is for a helicopter. And you just looked at those two on paper. Yeah, it's very difficult to say which is actually the more complex machine, right? Because you're solving problems that are unique to certain environments that may be more difficult or less difficult, depending on the application, right? Like rockets don't have to deal with, like, with the whole rotor head system, and that's complex control mechanism with all the dynamics involved there, right? But at the same time, you know, helicopters don't have to deal with the environmental aspects of flying to space, right? So they have their own different problem yeah. sets, and I wouldn't say one is necessarily easier or harder, right? But in general, you know, we've mastered, I would say humans have basically mastered the art of making a helicopter, though, right? Like I've seen, you know, where we've come from, the original helicopters that were literally look like they're made of sticks, right? To the first, you know, commercial helicopters, like, you know, with Bell and Sikorsky, and, you know, with the Blackhawk coming around, and we've progressed beyond that, right? Like we're seeing fully digital controlled helicopters. You know, there's no more your traditional. You move a stick that moves another stick that moves another stick that moves another. You know, like we're gone. We're done with that, right? Like we're going full digital. You can make a helicopter that looks like anything, that you can make it fly like anything you want with modern technology and controls, right? So, like, I would say we've pretty much mastered that degree, or mastered that aspect of the industry, and we're just trying to eke out every single little bit of performance or efficiency or automation out of it now. Whereas with rockets, I don't think we're at that level of mastery yet. Like, you know, we're still deriving a lot of new propulsion technologies and things like that to help make that travel to, you know, to and from space even more efficient, right? Especially like when it comes to reusability and things like that. We're still developing in that aspect, different materials, different controls, different, you know, types of, just generally different types of technology that will really let us master that, yeah. Right?
You know, I've flown DJI video drones before, and I, you know, in the early days, a few years ago, when I first flew them, I was like thinking to myself, and I wouldn't have brought this up if you didn't bring up the whole helicopter work experience that you have, but I've always wondered why drones were not first implemented in its own form before helicopters. Why did helicopters come before drones? Because drones with the four propellers pointing up and down just seems so much more efficient and much more manageable from a systems point of view than a helicopter. Like the helicopter just seems to have like this vertical and horizontal sort of these yeah. things working, and it just seems to be very inefficient and mm-hmm. complicated. Why didn't we have drone the drone mechanism before the helicopter mechanism? It doesn't make any sense yeah. to me.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, and it's interesting because it's like in retrospect, right? Like yeah. it's one of those things you can only ask in retrospect, right? Once you have the technology, you can look back. It's like, oh, this is so obvious. Why didn't we do this before? Right? You know, I'll answer to the best of my degree, and I'll have to make a few assumptions on things, right, with this type of answer.
And I just want to apologize to the audience how random this question is, but I didn't have this prepared because I just heard your helicopter. You know, I when I look at you and when I hung out with you, I always felt like you're some 25-year-old guy, not realizing you're in your mid-30s and you have more experience than I actually thought, because I thought you were just that blue coming out of school. You're a Blue Origin, and you know that's that's history, right? But no, I didn't know that 8 year at the helicopter company existed. So here we are. We're at this random intersection. I really want to know, though.
Yeah. So with the helicopter question and the drone question, so a fundamental difference between drones and I would say conventional, like helicopters meant for people and cargo, is that drones are electric, right? This is a field that the rotorcraft industry hasn't fully evolved into yet, right? So electric rotorcraft is a different animal than a conventional, turbine engine powered with a turbo shaft and gearbox type of engine, right? There's a lot of movement in the direction of electric rotorcraft, meaning the rotors are powered by motors, right? The linkages and everything like that to control the prop or the rotor blades are also kind of electronically controlled. So these have from my experience during my time there, the challenge with electronic with motors and motor with rotor blade control with motors is how much power that they're capable of delivering, how much load that these motors can handle, and how heavy they are. So the problem with today, if you were just want to, like, if you were to take like a Blackhawk, right, or I worked on 53Ks, which were huge, humongous, right, like gigantic helicopters, to just put an equivalent electric motor in there, this is where my limitations of the technology are limited here, and I have to make some assumptions, right? But my interpretation or my understanding of what the problem there was, these motors were not capable of the loads, right? Meaning like it can't handle like a mechanical, like a hydraulic system, right? Can handle really high loads, right? Like loads, meaning like when you fly through the air, like the air pushing against you, or when you're lifting something really heavy off the ground, like you're picking up a truck, right? With a helicopter. That's really heavy, right? It's really, it puts a lot of load on the airframe, a lot of load on the rotor blades, it puts a lot of demand of power in the powertrain system, right? Motors right now, from my time in the industry, motors have a limitation on how much load that they can handle, right? Before you start to back drive the motor or you overheat them, they get really hot, right? Like, so if you ever go out, I don't know if you ever had like a little toy with a little motor in it, right? Like, you know, if you grab the shaft of the motor, right? If you keep it still and you turn the motor on and that little shaft can't turn, that motor gets really hot, right? Because that current's not going, that electricity can't go anywhere. It's not turning something, right? And so if you think about it, instead of putting your hand on a little shaft that's stopping it from moving, you've all of a sudden attached that shaft to, you know, some rotor, some system that's handling a really high load. That motor gets really hot because it just can't handle it, right? Versus in a hydraulic control system, because it's not using a coil of wire to move something, and it's using literally hydraulic force, and hydraulics can be very strong, right? The technology isn't there where for large, heavy lift, high load, high performance type situations, the motor technology is not there yet. And in form factor and because of the loads that they can manage. So like drones is easy because drones don't pick up like tanks, right? Drones don't pick up aircraft. Drones don't pick up giant Connex boxes, right? Like drones don't pick up 20,000 pound loads, right? Drones pick up like an Amazon box, right? And how you're seeing them used in modern warfare now, they're dropping like little small ordnance, right? Like, I don't know, maybe 50 pound, 100 pounds. They're not dropping 5,000 pound bombs, right? Like, because they can't lift that, right? So that's where some of the limitations that I, from my time there, I understand that, well, why didn't we start with quad rotor, quad rotor electronic, rotors or propellers? And it's because, well, they don't have the same utility, right? For light recreation, for commercial, for hobbyists who are just carrying a little camera, fine, but you could totally do that, right? But like, you're not going to be lifting anything heavy. but once, when we get there though, right? Like when somebody invents the motor, some form of motor, or electronic, rotor system, that is capable of really high loads, then I think you'll see that shift. But we're not there yet. But the people in the industry are moving in that direction. When I left the company, there were a lot of R&D projects that are shifting towards how do we electrify our helicopters, right? And that's one of the problems, though.
This leads me to the next question, which is propulsion systems. Are we what's more important right now? Propulsion, like the ability to kind of power propulsion, or the rotor systems, you know, things that are like mechanically lifting us? Well, I mean, I think of a rocket and I think of the other side. It's very different technologies between a rocket, the helicopter, and even now when, you know, I know this is going to be sounding wacky. I mean, we get into this territory, which drifts into so many wacky things. But alien technology and the idea of propulsion, right? And we can't understand any of it, but the reports come out so often. What is the most important thing that people work on? And I can imagine it being propulsion energy systems. But I'm so confused about like where we can, you know, where humanity is actually going, because it seems like the end goal would be to be able to propel things the way that we see them in these videos of things moving with the speed of our imagination.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting one, right? So you have many different like methods of propulsion, right? And we as human beings have been bound to, our minds are bound to, you know, propulsion in the sense of it in an atmosphere, right? Or in fluid, like water, air, right? Like, and then so propulsion in space or on other extraterrestrial bodies like the moon or Mars, right? With atmospheres that are different. Yeah, it's a bit of a paradigm shift, right? Like you can't use a regular jet engine in space. There's no air to move, right? You can't use a helicopter in space. There's no air for the rotor blades to move, right? So with propulsion technology in space is really, it's a movement of mass, right? It's mass. And this is something they teach you in school, right? The only way to move something in space is to take, you know, like conservation of momentum, right? Like if you have two objects, right? The only way to make this one go left is to make this one go right. Like, so they have to go like this, right? So in space, they do that by ejecting mass out the back of the engine nozzle, right? Like fuel, right? Fuel becomes that mass, right? So you're shooting hot, you know, hot air, hot whatever, right? And there's even electron engines now, but that ejection is what's propelling you through space,
yeah, right?
Because there's no air for you to suck. So you carry your own fuel, and that fuel flying out the back of the nozzle at really high speed is what makes you fly through space, right? But on Earth, right, you're moving fluid around, like air is the fluid or water, right? Like you have your physics that go around your prop blade, or you have the physics in a turbojet engine, right? It's moving air that's over here that's not as fast. It's accelerating that air through combustion or whatever other means, and spitting the air out the back super fast, right? So those are like the modern, that's what we're constrained to as far as like propulsion technologies on Earth, right? We don't know what we don't know, right? So is there another form of propulsion that kind of shifts that paradigm of using, you know, of using a fundamental of conservation of, you know, of momentum, right? Of moving mass from here to there to move other objects around. Like, is there another way to create motion without that, that somehow just puts us on a whole nother level of
technology,
of technology, yeah, right? Like, I don't know, like, ooh, anti-gravity. Like, what does that even mean, right? Like, I have no idea what that would look like, right? But I'm sure there has to be, right? There's got to be another form of propulsive technology that is not constrained to the limitations that we have in engineering today. But it's one of those things where how do you know what that looks like? Because we don't know, right? Like, if you went back in time, right, and you told the person who's riding a horse, right, hey, did you know, you know, if you take this fuel and you compress it and then you light it on fire and you put it through a nozzle that's shaped like this, that you can actually go like 20 times faster than what you're going right now. And they're going to be like, I have no idea what you're talking about, right? Like, they because you don't know, right? You're bound by the limitations of what you perceive and you understand of the world around you, right? So how do you invent something that is just totally off the scale, right? I don't know. And I think that's where, you know, when you say, You know, how did they, if UFOs were real, right? That's a whole question on its own, right? And if they move like that, like what sort of propulsive technologies are they using, right? Like, who knows? And this is where, like, this is where the sci-fi kicks in. This is where we need, like, really creative people who write movies and books to just make something up, and then the engineering follows, right? Like, wow. You know, with George Lucas and Star Wars, yeah, come on, like, he's just making stuff up, right? Like, but at the same time, like, it's almost counterintuitive, right? And I really like this actually personally. It's like engineering sometimes follows the sci-fi, right? Like, because me, engineer, I'm not creative,
had
right?
No,
like,
I idea. Can't... This is so novel to hear this.
Yeah. So, but I think it's really cool, right? Because me as an engineer, like I'm very rigid. I'm very the way I think in boxes, right? Because everything is defined. Like everything has a finite solution, finite answer. Like, you know what I mean? Like it's square, right? So, but when it comes to like creativeness and fiction, you know, that's where people are coming up with ideas that are not bound by conventional understanding, right? So by crossing that layer, it's like, and then you show the engineer, like, you know, the engineer goes and watches Star Wars or watches some other sci-fi films, like, that's really cool, right? It's like, what can we do to make that? Right, because I wouldn't have thought of that. I only think of what I know can exist. Right, so, but how do you think of something that doesn't even exist? And then once you think of it, right, then the engineering follows. So I would love to see, you know, people come up with crazy ideas, and then an industry, you know, just adopt, you know, just kind of going and really embracing that. Like, how can we creatively really just go into the wild with new technology and new science and things like that? Right.
I mean, you think about Star Trek and Star Wars and all of these early sci-fi pictures, you know, Star Trek was having mobile phones, you know, beamed down from wherever they were, you know, to the floor of the planet that they were on. It was like the most crazy thing. And I don't even know if they had that technology, DARPA had that technology back then or not yet, but whatever he was drawing on, you know, the creator of Star Trek was spot on. And then they probably made the engineering work much, much later.
Yeah.
That all being said, now I wonder why, or to you, I want to hear, why is space travel important to mankind?
Yeah. So that's a really good fundamental question, right? So I think the easy answer to that is, and some people may agree and some people may not, is, you know, Earth is finite, right? There's only so much Earth, there's only so many resources, and there's a lot of constraints of being on Earth, right? That limit the human potential. So I know that's like a very general statement, right? I could mean a lot of different things like that, right? But I think some of the use cases now, like some of the things that are applicable today of why is space important for people? I mean, do you like your cell phone? You know, do you like having Google Maps? Do you like having people who use Starlink now? Like, do you like having internet in the middle of nowhere, anywhere you go, right? Things like that, right? Those are technologies that only exist because we are able to put things in space, right? And I think that's just the beginning of it, right? So beyond that, like if we can do this much just by orbiting the Earth, right? I mean, right. And I can't give you the answer because I don't know, right? But think about, well, what other things would what other sorts of like really creative, really remarkable things could you do by expanding that domain to interplanetary, right? To the moon, to the Mars, to other planets on the solar system, to other solar systems, right? Like, what other things are out there? What other forms of technology could you develop that would revolutionize the way humans operate? And that could be you know, some new material that's on another planet that we don't get much of here, right? Like, you know, we said, you know how like here was like, oh man, gold is so hard to find, silver is so hard to find, like manufacturing processes that are really expensive because they rely on really precious metals that only exist in certain places, right? Like, and then this one country who nobody likes or something like that only has them, right? So you you can create, I think there's a potential for like, you could find abundance, you know, elsewhere off of Earth that limit manufacturing. So that could be another avenue too, right? And I know there are technologies or there's research going on and progress in fields that are trying to look at how you can manufacture with regolith, right? Which is moon dust, right? It's literally what the moon's surface is made of, right? Like people are actively looking at how can you take this and use it as a raw material for manufacturing. And it's possible, right? There are things that you can do with this. And I know that Blue Origin has a patent on how you can use lunar regolith and develop solar panels, right? So think about that, right? Like if you can manufacture solar panels on the moon, right? There's electricity, there's energy, right? And from there, like the world's your oyster, right? So, you know, that could be very real too. So there's a great number of possibilities, but I think just limited to just the examples we see today, like with satellite technology, with communication satellites, with satellite imaging, with GPS. I think there's way more potential if you go beyond just an Earth orbit, right? And I would say most emphasis on industry, most of all, I think.
My God, we can spend hours just talking about the proliferation of different technologies like Velcro and, you know, solar panels that are made as a result of the space industry. And, you know, how far are we from colonizing not the moon, but like just colonizing another space station or a docking situation in our orbit that we can frequently go to?
So, I mean, we've already seen that with the ISS, right? The International Space Station. And that's been around for quite a while. Now, that one's going out of commission at some point, I think. But I mean, that will be replaced with others, right? And that'll be replaced with others using more modern technology. The ISS is pretty old, actually, if you think about it. Like, I don't know exactly how old it is, but, you know, I would say in engineering equivalent, it's probably pretty creaky and pretty old. Now, it's perfectly safe. I don't want to scare anybody about that. But I mean, like, there's a reason why they're talking about decommissioning the ISS, right? It's been up there for quite some time. But I can tell you there's work now that's happening about creating private versions of the International Space Station, right? You know, like Axiom is a company that's in the U.S. that I think they're working on things to create a private space station. Blue Origin has a concept for a private space station as well. It's called Blue Reef. So those are really cool, right? And then China and other countries in the world are also invested in creating international, or not international, but like their own versions of private space stations too. So I think we're going to see more of these. You know, some will be government, some will be private, some will be international. But that is happening now. So if you weren't aware, you know, people are going to build more space stations, and it's not just going to be limited to like NASA or you know, the European Space Industry or agency. It'll be a variety, right? And that's what the private sector is trying to open up. So you're going to see more for sure. Yeah.
As someone who's directly involved in this industry, if I were to ask you, hey, we got a lot of problems here on Earth. We got a lot of things to solve here on Earth. Why are you trying to solve these things? Why are you taking humanity to space? What's your answer to that?
I'd say you're right. There are a lot of problems on Earth. There's a lot of issues here on Earth that we're not dealing with before we go to space, right? I mean, that's true. You can't deny that, right? I mean, there's war, there's hunger, there's medical, there's disease. I mean, there's many, many, many reasons why you should focus on Earth first, right? I totally get it, right? It doesn't make sense to be playing around in space when you know you have family members that are sick with some incurable form of cancer, right? Like, why, right? But at the same time, I would say we cannot work in a serial process. Humanity cannot work in a serial process, right? Yes, there are important things that are happening that you could arguably say are more important than developing space technology right now, right? But the thing is, we cannot wait to solve these, you know, big obstacles that are facing humanity in line with one another, right? Like we can't wait to solve cancer first before investing in space technology, right? Like we can't wait to develop low cost solutions for housing. We can't wait to develop solutions for affordable and healthy food for the globe, right? Before, like, if you wait for all these things, you're never gonna make progress. And you're gonna be way, by the time you finish whatever this is you're doing over here, you're gonna be way behind over here, right? So I get it that there are near priority, hotter fires, right? There are near priorities that you should address that have high perception, that the public is aware of. But at the same time, like, you can't just totally cut it.
Yeah.
Right. Because otherwise by the time you finish it, whatever that you're focusing on first, you're just way too far behind on the other things that you should have also. So it's got to be a parallel thing, right? Like, you have to be able to do more than one thing. Humanity has to be capable of working and evolving in more than one aspect at a time. Like, if you do it any other way, you're already behind, right? You have to be like that.
Yeah. And this idea of being behind leads me to the next question about something you brought up when we were in New York, is the Lunar Gateway. Because when I think about, yeah, behind in what? Like, we're relatively, like, what does that even mean? But now, like, if you take the context of all of the countries participating in, I think it's the Lunar Gateway that you had, can you talk about that?
Yeah, so right now, this rocket is actually going to be launching soon. So NASA, right? I mean, they're still in the game. So they're about to launch their next really large rocket. It's called Artemis II. It's part of the Artemis program. And that program is going to be enabling basically a lunar space ecosystem, right? And Blue Origin is involved in this as well. We want to provide launch and space services that enable the transportation from Earth to this lunar ecosystem, right? And to and from the surface of the moon and back, right? So basically, you know, you can imagine a route, space route, you know, there's the long route, which is like from Earth to the moon. And then there's the short one that gets from Earth just to the Earth orbit. And then the last route, which is from around the moon down to the surface, right? So it's like a three-leg system. So this system, right, the station that orbits the moon, right, this part of the Artemis thing, is I believe they're calling it Gateway, right? And this is basically going to serve as like your halfway point or your gas station, you know, like, mm-hmm. your rest stop. I'll just use those words,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So that you hit that first, right? And then from there you go down to the moon, right? And then to go home, you do the opposite and come back. So that is in works right now with many, many different industry providers, to facilitate the ease of transportation, back and forth, from the moon. So that's a really big, and that's like happening now, right? That's like a project, that's a program. There's industry moving in that direction, like right now, to get those things, enabled.
Wow, this is not like some pie in the sky dream, some pipe dream. This is like actually going to happen. This is the way we're going to get to and from the moon in a very systematic 2-3 point rest stop system.
Yeah, yeah. So it'll happen. It's just when. The question is just when, and hopefully within before we get too old, right? So, but I think it'll be, I don't have a good timeline on it, but we'll see it within our lifetimes for sure.
So, for you, where do you see yourself? What is like the end goal of somebody like you? Are you thinking about, oh, in 10 years I'm going to be stationed on the moon with my family, and I'm going to be working from that side? If we're going to go from the moon to Mars, or we're going to go, like, what's your trajectory in your professional life?
Yeah, so I think there's many facets of that question. There's like, well, you know, do you want to follow the typical career path of any working American? It's like, you know, you work until some age and then you retire, you go to the beach and you drink margarita. You know, like, there's that answer, right? And then there's the answer of like, oh, you know, your my identity as an engineer never retires, right? Even if I work through, you know, all I can do, you know, at a corporate business, you know, what do I do after that? Like, where does my life end up? I mean, in my vision, I mean, I'm gonna be someone who makes things for the rest of my life. Like, I'm fundamentally an engineer, right? Like, I have to always be consumed with fixing things, making things, or something, right? Like, that's just my identity. Like, I can't imagine a life where I'm just sitting around and I'm not making something, right? Or improving upon something. You can't, like, you put me in a room with, you know, a bunch of random stuff, I promise you I'll build something out of it, right? Yeah. Like, that's just because that's just who I am, right? So, you know, whether I stay at Blue Origin until I retire or whatever retirement looks like, you know, I don't necessarily know. I guess for me, I do foresee me continuing to stay in some sort of field or industry that is, you know, aerospace related, or at least making something that's leading edge, right? Like, I've always, no matter where I've gone or worked or studied, I mean, what I do is always at the forefront of engineering technology, right? Like, the whole concept of aerospace in engineering and what I studied is like, you're learning about the latest and the greatest of, you know, these technologies and engineering associated with the aerospace industry, right? And along my entire career path, I've always been involved with R&D, right? It's all research and development. It's all experimental stuff. It's all brand new stuff. Like, I'm not working on things that we already know exist, right? Like, what I do now, like, I work on the rockets that are like brand new, you know, like, this isn't, and then the add-ons to those that make it even newer, right? It's like, hey, you thought this was new. Now we even have a newer version of this, right? So, like, I'm continuously being always working and being placed in sectors that are kind of at that forefront of technology. So I think I'll always be working on something new, something that we haven't developed before, new form of engineering. And then, you know, when I get old, I'll always be doing something, making something, whether it's building rockets in the backyard or whatever. You know, do I ever see myself like in space as someone who's an engineer? I mean, it's possible. I think it's possible. You know, eventually down the road, right? Once we start having more and more people in space, once we start having industry in space, you have to have people work there, right? Like, you can't have arguably, you could say with the advent of AI, maybe this makes things different, right? But for now, let's assume that AI can't entirely replace us. If you have a manufacturing facility, right, you got to have technicians, right? When things break down, you have to have an engineer figure out what's going on, right? You have to have a site manager. Like, you have to have somebody there to understand and facilitate the day-to-day operations, right? It's not going to be, I don't think yet, it's going to be exclusively on robots and AI, right? But maybe that will happen one day. But I think if we get to that point where we have enough industry in the world and are on other planets or in space or something like that, yeah, you're going to need like an engineer there. You're going to need some people there to fix things when they break. So, I think it's possible. Yeah. Like, you know, if I were to work on some new, you know, lunar habitation program and they're building it, and it's 50 years from now, they're building it, and it's like, hey, look, Kevin, you worked on this when they were designing it. You tested it when it was on the ground. Like, we need somebody there on site who knows how to fix it when the system breaks, you know, and we can't send a robot or whatever, right? Yeah. It's like, okay, well, someone's got to be there. So I think that's a real possibility of something happening like that. So maybe that could happen.
You know, I got to know you through your wife, who is in the Vietnamese film industry, and what a chance meeting both of you in New York. And I want to end with this thought, with this question about your life trajectory if you don't go to space, or rather, how involved do you think you and Vietnam and the space industry in Vietnam? I mean, how real is a space industry in Vietnam one day, and having somebody like you be a part of their program happening in Vietnam? I mean, I know it's probably a very limited question right now, because probably there's no industry, but I don't know if you know anything about it, if you have your finger on the pulse there.
So I do get those watch notices, you know, like on Google and stuff. You can set up like certain notices. So I did actually see, there's Viettel, I think, right? And then there's like Vin Group, right? So I know that Vin Group, I read an article, and you know, the people in Vietnam can vouch for this. I don't really know too much about it, but I saw that the CEO, the owner, had actually filed for the name of a new company.
Vin Space.
Yeah. So I saw that. I'm like, all right. So Vietnam's trying to get in the space game. It's like, yeah, I mean, it makes sense, right? That's a new hot thing. Everybody's getting into it. I mean, it makes sense, right? Like to be a global or
player.
Yeah, right. You have to start thinking about this, right? Whether that be satellites or launch vehicles or whatnot. And then there's telecom, right? Satellites, telecom. I mean, that's space too. And I know, I think I've seen things online about, I believe it's Viettel, right? Like the cell phone provider. I think they have satellites. And then that's technically space too, aerospace. Now, not in the sense that we think like Hollywood, right? It's more like cell phones and things like that. But I mean, depending on where he goes with Vin Space, depending on where that goes, I mean, it's possible that they would draw international engineering community to the country. So if they want to keep pursuing that route, then I would highly, you know, encourage that side of that Vietnamese sector to keep pushing for that. There needs to be support from the government too, right?
Of course,
Like there's private, and then there's, because you're talking about flying through the air, and there's also government regulations and support with the industry there. So I don't know, maybe if Vietnam were to create their own version of the space, like a VSA, yeah. You know, Vietnam Space Agency or something like that. I mean, those would be the stepping stones that would be something that I would be interested in seeing. But I think one more aspect of that is, and unfortunately, it's with the politics, right? Like, you know, with the history with the U.S. and the government, with the party in control over there, it's a tricky conversation when you're talking about space. Because space, there's the civil side of it, right? And then there's the military side of it, right? Yeah. And it's hard to separate the two, right? Aerospace engineering is innately combined with the military. Right, because we create the latest tech, we create the newest things, and trust me, whenever you make something new, the military is going to want to know about it. Like you know what I mean? Like you can't engineer something, a new technology, and not have the military catch on. So it's always been intertwined, right? Like, and a lot of the things that we work on fall behind a lot of international law and politics with the U.S., like the U.S. government. There's export control. There's lots of things that restrict the ability to convey information between the countries. Like hell, I even remember like when I was in school, it's like my professor, I think he told me one day, like, you see this textbook? You can't bring this textbook, you can't bring this to China, you know, or things like that. Because the information in that book would enable you to build military technology, right? Like it's fundamentally the things that I know in my head can be used for good and bad, right? Like we can make things that fly people and expand humanity as a common people. But at the same time, if I really wanted to, the things I know in my head could be used to just kill as many people as you want, right? Like it's a double-edged sword. So that's where the technology and the politics gets a little tricky. Right. So like
murky.
As an American, as a Vietnamese American who lives, you know, I have U.S. citizenship and anything like that, working in Vietnam for an aerospace industry or in the space industry, because industry is, you know, inexplicably tied to military, you know, space and military is always going to be tied together. That would be very difficult, I think, for any Vietnamese American or any American, anybody really, who got their education and works in industry in the U.S. and wants to move that experience to Vietnam. I think there's probably I have to maybe talk to a lawyer to confirm all of this, right? But I think that would be an obstacle that would limit how much you could really do, because I could see especially like if you have a clearance, right? Like if you worked in a and I have had to work with people and in sectors where a clearance was required, right? And I can tell you, if you had a clearance or ever were thinking of one, and you go work in the space industry in Vietnam, and you happen to work on a military, you know, rocket in Vietnam, that's going to come up on your, you know, that's going to come up. And they're like, oh, who did you work for? Okay, you know, what party is in control over there? Okay, yeah, you know, I don't know. We will want to employ you in the U.S. Wow. Because you have those connections, right? But that's a real thing. So now, but that's a very unique American problem, right? Because you know, America doesn't like the party in control in Vietnam, right? From a political point of view. So there's going to have to be a lot of development politically, internationally, between U.S. and politicians to how do you enable that international flow of you know, advancement of technology and collaboration in that field, right? How do you enable that? But at the same time, how do you limit the problem of it being tied to like arms and the military, right? So that's always been a challenge. And I know even for the longest time, I think maybe in the last 5 or 10 years, I remember it was actually pretty interesting news that the U.S. actually for the first time allowed trade of certain restricted items to Vietnam. I think it was engine parts, like Pratt & Whitney engines, I believe, something like that. But they were allowed to like sell them parts, or they allowed Vietnam to actually like make them there for the first time, like, you know, and even that was like, oh, well, hey, they're finally kind of like starting to open the doors a little bit, because, you know, making stuff like that over there that is based on U.S. tech, you know, could in some ways you can consider that a violation of the international arms and regulations and things like that. So is it possible? Yeah. Would I like to see it? Yeah, of course. I mean, working in a brand new environment over there with a different culture, different people would always be exciting. Yeah. But at the same time, like, I think we have a lot of politics that have to be figured out before you can see a fully transparent link of American to Vietnamese aerospace industries, you know, working collaboratively. I think there's a big political block between that.
Yeah. Kevin, this has been quite an enjoyable conversation. This is one of the longest conversations I've had in a long time. Typically they're about an hour, but I could sit here for a lot more. I hope to have you back on, because I think that Blue Origin's probably, you know, having something up their sleeve again, like Amanda Nguyen, Katy Perry, all these wonderful women being put in space and coming back down safely. So I look forward to the next thing that you guys do, and hopefully we can get back on the podcast to talk about that.
Yeah, just look out on the calendar. You're going to see a couple launches soon for our bigger rocket. Hopefully, within the next couple months, you're going to see a couple. So stay tuned, watch the news.
I might have to take my kids out to Florida to come visit you. It sounds like a really interesting place. I sure will. Kevin, thank you so much once again.
Okay. Thank you, Kenneth. It was great talking to you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.